we're doing the Brain Trust podcast. Once again, I'm Adam Vass, a tabletop game designer in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
And I'm Will Yopes, a tabletop game designer in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Adam, it's been a minute. What's up?
I am just surviving out here. Can you hear the rain?
Can you hear the rain on your skin? I've got this loud skin here in the rain. It's a rainy day here in Toronto, and it's kind of been a rainy day, psychically speaking, for the last month or so. Do you feel that?
It's like freezing rain here.
Sick.
And it is coming into my home.
Inside?
I stepped in a cold puddle this morning by the back door, and I like can very easily see where it's coming from, this window that doesn't close all the way, and I've done nothing about it. It's just...
It's fine.
Oh, that's a look feature. Out for the puddle.
Rain is invading your home.
Yes.
I like having experiences that I know people had 4,000 years ago. That's one of them. People were dealing with that when the pyramids were being constructed.
So yeah, rain, go away. Come again some other day.
The old man is snoring.
We're doing a breakfast record today, a brunch record.
And, we're brunching.
It was definitely difficult to rally for this because of the weather.
Oh, I woke up today, and when I wake up, I try and have at least one straight up costume change a day. That's kind of the work from home vibe. I don't know if you're on that tip, but getting into different clothes halfway through the day, that is like a shot of epinephrine into my heart. It's like just going to get me going. But I wake up, I put on my Good Look Press hoodie, and I put on some sweats, and I do some work, right? I will like write or do some other like high creative task, maybe like do a little painting, draw a little bit. If it's a work day, I'll write or something. And then when 11 a.m. rolls around, we get to noon, I'm putting on real person clothes to do the real work. Emailing. Opening a computer program to do something inside of. It's one of the main things I do now.
I kind of do the opposite of this, where I...
You're naked till noon.
Well, I wear regular clothes. Really, the distinction for me is jeans versus joggers.
Okay.
And it gets to a point around 6 or 7 p.m. where I go, it's jogger time, baby.
We are kind of like two circling spirits, right? That like I begin my day with soft clothes and you end your day with soft clothes.
Yeah.
Interesting. What, for me, it's like when I wake up, I'm like a morning writer. That's just a thing about me that I've learned. That like I'm most creative and most unburdened by my own brain in the morning. So I can just hop on, sit down for 2 hours for writing time. If I write, that's great. If I can't get any words out, that's fine. It's just the time that I spent on writing. And if I just don't make any choices in the beginning of the day until I get to my computer, I find that I'm just like an explosive wizard of creativity. If I have to like pick like, oh, what shirt am I going to wear? Is this shirt going to feel weird today or something? I'm kind of in an era where a lot of shirts are feeling a little weird to
me. Oh, I get that. Yeah.
Dude, it sucks.
I have regular emotional breakdowns over this.
It's the worst.
This used to fit me and now it does not.
Not only the fitting thing, like that's just, it sucks, but it's like a shirt will change in the wash in a way, or I will like be more bloated one day than another day, and I will just be like, I feel horrible. I want to die.
My big insecurity, and you're taller than me, so this is probably true too, is just like, is the shirt tall enough?
Oh.
If I reach up to grab something, will my belly show? And that is like seemingly unrelated to width and tightness. It's just its own dimension that will ruin my day.
God. I used to wear those fucking 2010s long shirts.
Classic.
You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? Tall tee. And I felt like I pulled it off. I don't know anymore. Yeah, the fucking shirts. I feel like... and then when I'm like, okay, I'm having like a high body dysmorphia day, I'm going to wear a looser shirt. Sometimes when the shirt is too loose, I feel like I have too much of my body that I am aware of. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I deliberately will get specifically sweaters and long sleeves in a too big size. And my favorite thing is to wear them during ingestion of cannabis, because then I'm like, I'm a little guy in a big shirt. But I also really like it in winter. Like, I have a Sopranos crew neck sweater that's too big, and it just is like, I live in this. I am Tony style.
I think that's perfect. Like, I'm talking about, like, I've got a t-shirt that I really like wearing. It's like a comfort tee, and it's just a big heavyweight cotton shirt, and sometimes it's just like too heavy in a way that just makes me like, if I'm sitting on the couch, I'll just be too much aware of my body, and that's usually pretty much a game over, mentally speaking. Mm-hmm. If you're getting there,
there's no coming back from that.
Yeah, long sleeve shirts are great. I like hoodies because I'm doing it right now. I can have the hood up and my body can kind of focus on a different part of me being covered by clothes.
Yeah.
No problem with the head, right? That's fine. But yeah, I definitely am in the comfort cloth time right now. So that's the energy I'm bringing.
I'm in it too, actually. It's funny because I take 2 weekdays as my weekend. I don't work on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. But then the real weekend happens Saturday and Sunday, and I go, all right, this is a weekend. Weekend vibes.
Kind of a weekend-flavored work day.
So I do aspire to work. We'll see. But
if I get to it, that would be great.
Yeah, I'm wearing joggers right now. That's... What the hell is this sound? I keep, like, doing something that makes something in this room bounce.
Oh.
And I think it's, like, I have, like, a little LED, like, tracing table that I draw with. I think it's that. But it bounces at this, like, parabolic graph approaching one. Like, the distance between two bounces is always half of the prior one. So it'll never fully reach one, but it will get faster and faster until you don't notice the difference between them.
Oh my god. So that's like one of those YouTube math channels that makes math cool, and they're like, here's what happens when you divide by pi every time, and it's a cube hitting a wall. Have you seen that one?
Not specifically, but like the energy.
Yeah, for listeners, Adam lives in a life-size game of Mousetrap fully set up. So that's kind of why you're hearing stuff.
Yeah, it's a combination of Mousetrap and Don't Wake Daddy, because all I can do is try to sleep through the terror of this impending cage.
You know, I'm going to take my time as a game designer and on this podcast as a platform to say that I never fucking understood Mousetrap as a child, and I think that sort of game design is despicable, okay? I'm supposed to build something crazy as a board game or knock it down? I'm not even really sure. I had this game. I played it a lot. Played in quotes. Lots of quotes around played. I do not know the action of Mousetrap.
Yeah, I don't. I think there's a distinction between like what the players do, what the characters do. Because the characters are the mice.
Alder on Mousetrap. What do the characters do? What do the players do? And how do they do it?
The characters are the mice, and I think they're in like a roll and move game. But the players are the ones crafting this trap, and so there's this weird, like, disconnect between what I want as a player, which is to win, and what I want as a mouse, which is to not get trapped.
Right. The last thing I want is a mouse. But yeah, I think it's a level of like empathetic embodiment that I, as a 7-year-old, would not get for years. Like, that is far away. And so I would just ignore the game and then build the trap. And the trap was so, like, silly, complicated, and strange. Just lots of, like, injection-molded plastic pieces. Where is the fucking Kingdom Death version of Mousetrap where you're building, like, a giant, like, guillotine. Clockwork? Yeah, with, like... You know, it's Kingdom Death, so it needs some just, like, gratuitously sexualized demons.
I want to almost blow this episode up and say, why don't you and I hop in Tabletop Simulator and roleplay a Mousetrap right now? I genuinely wonder if Mousetrap... I mean, like, I feel like Tabletop Sim is for, air quotes, like, elevated games. I can't imagine, like, Parker Brothers has a presence there. But that would be fun.
Yeah, I'm just going to open up just a picture of Mousetrap just to, like, reacquaint myself, because it is a level of, like, game production that I will never have access to. I just Googled Mousetrap, and I see a lot of things for killing real animals.
Oh, no.
I see and pictures of it in action. All of these Amazon Mousetrap photos have a little JPEG mouse around
Jesus.
The trap, just showing you, like, they're going to – this guy likes it. Okay, so Googling Mousetrap, there is a game where there is a big toilet with eyes on it, and it's called, let's see, it's called Shoot the Poop.
Obviously.
Wow. I have to make a game about piss or poop or something. That's what I'm not, see, that's kind of what I'm, why I haven't really cracked through yet.
Yeah, that's where our ceiling currently is.
Yeah, we'll not approach piss. Okay, so here are the ingredients in a mousetrap. Can you remember of them any offhand if you're not looking?
I'm already looking.
Damn it. So there is a loaded Luger pistol on the table. There's a Bowie knife embedded. There's, like, a ski slalom thing that drops a little ball, and that's how it starts, right? Like,
oh, this is just the beginning.
This is just the beginning. And then it goes down. Every piece is a different color, and not in, like, in a way that seemed like the factory told us that it would have to all be different colors. Does that make sense?
I think it's, like, oh, it's my guitar that's making that sound, I think. I think it's like if you land on a red space, you have a red piece of the
machine. Oh, you make a
machine.
Red piece, yeah.
I'm not really sure.
Yeah, this game a little bit bums me out for some reason. I think it's because it's Candyland-esque, right? There's very little you can do to influence what's going on in a children's game way. And... there is no creativity, right? You're just building the machine from start, from cold every time. How would you improve Mousetrap? How would you take this kind of players are trying to destroy the characters kind of game?
Oh.
Kind of like an elusive character style game.
It's interesting because it's like all... kids games, it's play to win, and it's also
play to earn.
Seemingly
kids are playing to earn
only luck based. So because I think there is an aspect of Mousetrap where you want to see the trap go down, right? Like that's kind of the best play experience of the game, is the whole machine works its magic.
Yeah,
so I think the players just aren't the mice. I think they're like exterminators, or even just like the family whose home is plague ridden with these vermin. Because there's this crazy cognitive dissonance of let's build this crazy mouse trap, but also you're a mouse.
Don't make me move the mouse that you're asking me to kill.
You're a class traitor.
Yeah, you are. You are like waging psychological warfare against these living beings. Yeah, do you know the game Kill Dr. Lucky?
I do not.
It is a super great classic board game where you each play someone who wants to kill Dr. Lucky. And the board is full of squares, and overlaid on top of it is like the layout of a house. And Dr. Lucky has a path that he will move through the house on that everyone can see. So the game is positioning your person with the right implements and the right cards somewhere along that path to see if you can kill Dr. Lucky. It's super fun, and it feels like that is a good kind of sub on the mouse trap formula, in that it's like you want to kill someone.
Mm-hmm.
The mouse trap is a little bit too insidious because it's like you have trapped the mouse. It's like the mouse trap is leaving the results open for the children to imagine. What happens after we trap the mouse? How come every time we play there are mice that we need to trap? Who kills the mice? So you can get the Hasbro expansion for Mousetrap. Is called Mouse Executioner, and it's a little bit different. But yeah, I think something like that. I was watching that first Jason Bourne movie the other day.
Okay.
Really good. Super good. And I wanted to play a game where... Have you seen it?
Not in a long-ass time.
So, like, Jason Bourne, he's got friggin' amnesia, and he's running around Europe. And the CIA then activates the other Jason Bourne-style guys in Europe to come and get him. And there are four guys. And they know where he's going to be. They don't know what his deal is. But they're all trying to, like, one-on-one come and get him. And so my idea is that the game is you are all of these agents trying to get the super spy. And so you have to, like, outthink the super spy so the GM can be this, like, elevated all the information metagaming character, while the players, they do the thing that we love. They work together, use their quantum brain to outsmart the GM. And it feels like a pretty natural tabletop thing. So I wonder if we can take like that, add some mousetrap energy, and make it something.
So I guess the important ethical question at the front of Mousetrap is, are mice bad? Are mice inherently bad? Now, I don't want mice in my house.
My game presupposes is maybe they are.
I don't want mice in my house. You know, I have like the probably have talked about this on the show before, but my oldest tendency is I hate birds, and
okay.
I have on my street. I live on a pretty quiet street, so there are swallows everywhere. Or sparrows, which to me are just mice that can fly, and they like.
I didn't know this about you, that you hated birds.
They just chirp all day, and that's my. I hate like noise things. But also they will like full on build a nest in my window shutters or my gutter, and so right now they're building one on the window shutter to my office windows. So like. If I hold my breath for a second, you might even hear some chirps.
I can hear them.
They're feet away from me, you know? Like,
wow.
I hate them. I can't remember why I started this, because I just get so riled up with them.
That are mice evil? Are birds evil?
Oh, sparrows are mice, but birds. And they are evil, no doubt. So...
They've got villain programming.
By the transitive property, I think mice might be evil.
So are rats evil?
I honestly, I'm gonna confide in you right now. Do not know the difference between a mouse and a rat.
Yeah, so basically they level up at level 25.
It's
into rats.
Ratata and
Raticate.
Raticate.
So basically, rats have hyperfang, and mice just have scratch.
Okay.
No, okay, here's the difference. I'll tell you. I've had both in Boston. Boston, during the Big Dig in Boston, you lived here like at the end of the Big Dig. They unearthed a rat warren, which is like a country that rats own. That's a good way to think about it. That dispersed rats through the entire city, making the neighborhood of Alston into Rat City. But I've had both in apartments, and the difference is that mice don't want to deal with you. They just want to go to food.
Yeah.
And rats don't have that taboo.
Mice are an accident, and rats are on purpose.
Yeah. Rats have the capability to plan, if that makes sense.
Okay, so let's just round up and say that they're all evil, and our game intent is to purge them in some way. But
I like that you are vegan and no part of this kind of like PETA caricature thing is a part of it.
I hate more animals than I love, for sure.
That's good. That's
I don't healthy. Eat fish that's... because have you seen a fish, dude? They're disgusting.
They're filled with poison.
Absolutely.
Right? It's like
gnarly little creature alien freaks. And that's why you shouldn't eat them.
We're living in this weird tin fish era.
Oh,
where like,
yeah.
Tin fish dates. If you go on a tin fish date, stop recording it. Just, you can do it. Stop recording it and making me watch.
So we're making a game. The mice are evil. Are we mice in play?
Oh, you know what? That's an attractive idea, that I am an evil mouse. Like, I can personify a lot of mice's deeds into evilness and then be an evil mouse.
So I think then there's also, like, I think with Mouse Trap the game, you're supposed to get the cheese and not get trapped. But we as players want to build the trap. So in our game, I think we want to do evil deeds without any of the like consequences of that.
It's like a push your luck. Like, how much can I get before they get an exterminator?
I'm picturing it's like a Reservoir Dogs. Like, we're all in this cheese heist, but none of us like each other, and we're all out to get the whole pot. Like, only one of us can get the pot. The cheese.
Yeah, we're different freaks and psychos all band together. We don't trust each other. We're using false names.
Yeah, but we have to work together because one mouse cannot get the cheese.
No. I really like that. I really like Cheese Heist. And so I think we pick from like different playbooks or something that say that like, okay, I am the bruiser character, or I'm the kind of chess master.
Mr. Pink,
exactly. And I just want to do the scene where Stuck in the Middle with You is playing and a mice is like just slicing off
the huge, like, cartoonishly large ear of another mouse.
Yeah. I want that. The goal is to get the cheese. I wonder what the kind of table presence for this is. Like, are traps being built in different
I think it's
ways?
Mouse Trap. I think we're playing this. We're building this game around the board game Mouse Trap.
Okay, so there are spaces with colors. Maybe each color represents, like, a different card that you pull that has something.
I think...
And...
Sorry to interrupt. I think the trap is being built... we have to, as players, facilitate it. But it is the sort of, like, dread Jenga tower of the cops are coming after us.
Yeah. Yeah, like, play starts once the cops have been called.
The gig is up.
Yeah, so like the thing in Reservoir Dogs is we begin the movie when they've already stolen shit. And so when you're playing through Mousetrap, you know that one of you is going to go down and it can't be you. And so you're rebuilding what happened during the heist in play.
Wow.
While the cops are closing in on you.
And we can color code prompts with the pieces of the trap.
Ooh.
To be like, red is a moment that the plan went belly up.
Yeah, and like
yellow is a moment where you gotta break away.
Shot.
Like,
yeah.
And as you're building the mousetrap trap, you're narrating these moments of the heist that were particularly of interest.
Oh, blue can be like when two people teamed up and no one knew about it, when a secret alliance happened.
The not, like the silent nod.
Yeah, exactly. They're like, yeah, we're going to kill Mr. Pink. Oh my God. And it even works with like, you got Mr. Yellow, Mr. Blue. And so by the time you reach the end and the trap is built, you play Mousetrap as normal. And yeah, when the machine goes off, the game is ended.
Yeah, like one. I think there almost has to be like a, we add a piece, like we add a card or something that's like, you're in possession of the jackpot. And that possession changes hands over the course of play. So it could be like, you know, Mr. Blue knows that the cheese is in the trunk of the, of this car that's parked outside. But ooh. Mr. Green saw them put it in there. So there's like a turn that takes place where like Mr. Green moves the car so Mr. Blue doesn't have it anymore. So when the trap goes down, does that person also have the information or like the access to the honeypot? So like, because not only do you not have to get trapped then, you also have to have or know where the treasure is.
I love that. It almost makes me want to throw away Mousetrap and make like the Reservoir Dogs game where you're playing Old Maid. Are you familiar with that game?
Remind me, because it's also been like 20 years.
Yeah, everyone at the table, you got like four players, you divide up the deck between all four players dealing everything, and you're trying not to end the game with a Queen of Hearts. And the way the game works is you pick a card from someone else's hand. And if you have a book of cards, so like all matches, you discard them from your hand so you have less cards. And so it's this kind of like social deduction card counting game thing where you're trying to figure out where this card is and try and either not have it or in this design, you try and be the last person with that card. So it's like each time you discard a book or whatever, depending on the cards that you have, say it's like Kings. And Kings is a prompt that's like, how did you collude with the FBI on this one to get you?
I was just thinking, Kings are the cops or the feds or whatever. So yeah. Like, you have the one old maid or you have the card that you establish as the reward. Jackpot. And yeah. Then you also have these like threat cards or whatever. So like, you don't want the fed and the treasure card in your hand at the end of the game. Like, so oh. There's this additional quality of like, yes, you want the treasure card, but you have to get rid of the feds or the whole thing's for not, like, you're going to get busted.
Oh, that's cool. And like, I really love like taking classic card games and then adding one role playing mechanic. So you could just be adding heat, like your heat level one by round two. And that means you only draw one card from someone else's hand. But when you get to heat level 5 at the end of the game, you have to take 5 cards and just, like, deal with the ramifications of that.
Yeah, and I like the, like, placing a set down triggers a story prompt.
Yeah.
Maybe the number of sets placed down is the heat track.
Oh, I like that.
Because then there's this natural ramp of there are less cards available, so things are getting more dire.
I really like the idea of having some face-up cards that, like, say things about what's happening in the story. So, like, if you have a face-up king in front of you, it means you're going to go down when the game's over. And so you got to try and get it away somehow.
Accidentally a good thing again.
We did it. We're back.
Sometimes you just got to take a little month breather and then come back with the heat.
You got to take a month off to do a huge amount of work and then come back and you're great.
Let's throw in a quick break and then do more brain trust.
And we're back on the Brain Trust podcast Today we're celebrating the release of Adam's latest game, Sweet Revenge.
Yeah, it's out now at gotohell.io.
Yes.
You can also get the whole game for free on playroll.com. The PDF, the demon zine that I did just sort of as like a fun little art experiment. There's a branded virtual tabletop space that has all the character sheets built into it. It's awesome and it's free. So playroll.com has Sweet Revenge. But
Roll is where all the heaters live.
Yeah, I really like it a lot as a designer and getting to like figure out how to make character sheets for it and stuff. And then also just the immersion of like this room looks like this game does a lot to get you into this play space. But I'm working on getting Necronautilus and Babes in the Wood up there pretty soon. Basically going to like retroactively get all my games in there. But
that's the best. So for people that either missed the pre-orders or otherwise were just asleep, what is Sweet Revenge?
Sweet Revenge is an old school inspired adventure game where you are a dead soul going through the depths of hell to make one final demand from the devil. As you go down through hell, you're encountering demons and beasts, and you're battling them and collecting their fragmented souls as this currency, and also your XP and your health, this like meta currency. And you're using the seven deadly sins as your stats, so you're channeling these sort of the evil forces, the things that brought you to hell in the first place are the tools with which you interact with hell. So, yeah, it's kind of old school dungeon crawly. It's vaguely Weird West inspired. It's basically just like hell is its own thing that exists outside of a standard setting. And each little pocket of hell that you encounter is its own kind of like mini plane, in the same way that Necronautilus planets are kind of interactive but isolated.
Kind of like levels or something like that, stages.
Yeah, and you can go through one entire circle of hell, face off with the demon there, and still not get what you want and have to go do another one.
That is radical. And this was part of the and the initial spark was from the Record Collection Jam, right?
Yeah. Record Collection happens every January. It's a jam where people make records or games based on records or records based on games or songs. Ooh. Or whatever. There's this very cool... I've been doing it pretty much every year since I started publishing games because that's my wheelhouse, the music and game intersection. So this one is based on Three Cheers for Sweet Revenge by My Chemical Romance. All the like powers, the special powers and stuff are named after My Chem lyrics. And there's like, it's loosely based on the sort of vague story or concept of the album. There's
cool.
Just like a lot of bleed. And then obviously the black, white, and red aesthetic of the zine is very MCR inspired.
The zine itself is like totally gorgeous. It is like super deep, bold colors that just feel, they've got this like almost cursed royalty feeling to it.
Yeah.
That I love. It looks so cool.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a fun experiment to do that more modern graphic design kind of stuff integrated with a more old looking traditionalist art aesthetic, because I used all public domain illustrations of demons and hell and stuff as the art, and then just like played with the type and the shape of the paintings and like made this cool hybrid.
I love how the cover itself is just like such a beautiful composition. And I told you in private how much I love it, but just looking at it still blows me away. It is like such an elevated, taking like modern poster design that my big problem with like big Instagram poster designers, like the graphics will be so cool, but the content will be absolutely meaningless. Mm-hmm. Like it's usually something like work hard or like all you need is love, something like that. Or I'm tired. It's usually that. And then this just like matches your artistic and poetic sensibilities and graphics in such a way that just like it's screamingly good. And the print edition too, just like the textures almost pop off the cover.
Thank you. Yeah, I really
it looks biological.
And I'm very happy with the result, especially feel like this one more than a lot of games that I make is threading that needle of how much time is worth putting into this to make something that's still cool that doesn't go out of scope and doesn't like blow up my brain. I got it done and it looks cool, but it also didn't break me. And I also mentioned on Twitter that because I was funding it on my website and I wasn't having to do all the sort of tertiary stuff that comes with running a Kickstarter campaign, that
it really is the primary stuff. Like it's such a
right
brain drain. Yeah,
that I could just work on the game. So it's delivered, less than 3 weeks after the campaign ended because I could actually work on it instead of working on all the other bullshit. That's novel. That's a new experience for me.
Fuck yeah! I feel the same way with Plasmatics, which is also up for pre-order, where the last Kickstarters are a lot. Even when you have your game done, when you're going to Kickstarter, you are entering the same kind of release emotions and announcement emotions at the same time. And it is just everything is 10 times harder. It is even announcing a game is very difficult. Releasing a game is very difficult. And doing a Kickstarter is like the cocktail of both of those.
Yeah. That you have to continue drinking for a month.
Yeah, like you are suddenly sharing something with stakeholders instead of offering something you've made, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
And this is a whole tangent, but I wonder how much of that is based in this sort of indie RPG culture that is like we're bringing unfinished work to Kickstarter. Versus the board game culture that is, this is a pre-order for a game we just have to manufacture.
You know, I think that's such a good point because often indie game Kickstarters and RPG Kickstarters will literally have a stretch goal tier or a funding backer tier that has the backers contribute to the completion of the game.
Yeah.
And, I think that there's really good reasons to have that, and I think there's really good reasons not to do that. Like, at one point, it is just creating potential scope and blocking issues that can tank a project, make something take months longer than it might need to be. Or it could just be you are inviting a collaborator who is their only contribution to you and why you want to work with them is their money, and it's something tricky that I don't really have a fleshed out idea about, but other than it's a little funny.
Yeah, and it could go south.
Yeah, I mean, I think you and I both are trying to bring things that are finished to Kickstarter. There's this interesting conversation about how much should you finish before you get to Kickstarter? How much should you be making after Kickstarter? And I think we both, and correct me if I'm wrong, but we both feel like finishing something before you have this big event happening, whether it's like finishing the major creative touches in writing or finishing the visual identity or things like that, it is 100 times harder after because you begin a clock when you will run out of money mm-hmm. to make it worth it for you before you start making negative rate.
Yeah, what is this like, worth is the question that you're asking yourself every day.
Yeah, like, is it worth, you know, did I create a visual identity? So Torque, for example, I created a visual identity that simply just needed weeks of work to do. And it's still worth it today to have done that, but knowing that before the campaign, you know, really what the cost was, personally, I might have done something different or reduced the scope or Torque's a bad example because that game extremely grew. But yeah. Yeah, what do you think of that?
This Sweet Revenge is my one, I would say, instance of success where the campaign helped me recognize the scope. It was visually defined well enough. Like, I started the layout before the campaign launched. And I said, okay, I'm not going to do original illustrations for this.
Nice.
Because I made $1,500. For transparency's sake, this game raised $1,500, which on Kickstarter would not be an adequate amount for funding, especially with the cuts and fees and stuff. But so I said, okay, like, that's fine. That's...
Let's cook. Let's see what I can do.
Yes, and let's also understand that a $1,500 project, which is mostly going to cover print costs and shipping costs, is not going to be my next tentpole. And so it doesn't require 3 months of work.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and that's good to know. And it's something that I can't know before the campaign. It's something that I had to learn during and after the campaign that says, okay, like, this is fine. And fine is not bad. You know, like, it is just an interesting learning experience to not necessarily demote something in your mind, but just, like, accept something for what it is. And
you're able to, like, scope it the right way.
And truthfully, that's what most zine projects need.
Yes, absolutely.
If you're not making a book and you're making a zine, which, again, like, not to gatekeep, not to be particular, but there is a difference there, and the intent of the creator should probably be very different. It's okay. I was going to say it's okay for it to suck, and I think that's true. But there's probably a nicer way to put that of just, like, stop worrying. How I learned to stop worrying and love the zine.
That's the name of the episode. Thank you. I'm just going to write that down. I think that's perfect, right? Because when we make art, especially that we make books and zines and printed words and games, is that I say this a lot, and it just bears repeating, that releasing something is only one moment in this thing's creative life. And it's like art. It's life as being an art object. And zines have this ability to turn around new editions because there's not this upfront cost and limit to, like, oh, I had to buy 500 copies of this book. I cannot touch the content of this book in a meaningful way until it's time for a reprint, or I risk a disaster where I have a bunch of books that I can't sell. With zines, you can move them quicker. There is a less rigorous standard for them in every way, but I feel like zines can easily reach the same heights that a beautiful book can.
Yes.
And so it's much more calm and at the same time ambitious, because you can go wild and overwork yourself on something. And I love that aspect of how I learned to stop worrying and love the zine.
I think that's been something we talk about for a long time and want to enact in our publishing, but it's hard. And I think it's especially hard when you get on that path of, well, one, being full-time, and that's not necessarily... I have a lot of opinions on people going full-time.
Same. Maybe we should talk about that next app, because that's a good thing to talk about.
But generally speaking, it's not a real possibility. I mean, it can be, like, I don't know, maybe I'm just, it could be coming from a jaded place, but I think it's just, like, not meant to be that. And because we live in capitalism, like, you know, like, of course we would all love to do our creative stuff 24 hours and not have to do anything else, but I don't think just making $10 games on Itch is a full-time career.
Right. You And yeah, I think I hear what you're saying in that you just have to live in this space where the creation of the game and the production of the game is kind of the same thought. And you have to hold both of these in your mind to know that, like, I really can't spend 6 months making a zine that I can sell for $10 and reasonably sell for whatever. You have to, like, bring the scope to every level of the conversation. This is, like, permeated Good Luck Press in such a way that we have table of contents proposals that we're like, okay, here's what this game looks like. Here's the form factor. Here's how long it is. Here's the structure of it. So you have this kind of shape of what it's going to be before you get in, and it becomes like a de facto design document that is super helpful and refreshing to revisit and be like, I actually decided 2 months ago that this thing needed to be a 30-page scene, and I'm going to stick to
it. One of the tricks of what we do, too, is staying true to that and listening to yourself and not saying, like, well, what if I added an adventure and now it's a 48-page soft cover? Like, yes, that's enticing. That can happen. Try to resist it. Like, just know what the thing that you're making is and resist the sort of devil's temptation that is, you know, sometimes you'll get a breakaway on Kickstarter and you'll have three times as many backers as you want. That shouldn't change what the thing that you're making is.
Oh my God, that's such a good tip.
That's such, like, a trap. And it's this weird illusion, too, of like, more people want this, so I should work more on it. But like,
so I should, yeah, exactly. And the people wanted the thing you proposed, right? They don't want, you might think that, like, oh, all of these people are kind of amalgamating into one person spending whatever amount of five-digit number it is on this game. No, it is this group of people each spending for this thing you told them they would be buying. Literally do not need stretch goals. You don't need a complicated backer arrangement. Like, you figured it out. You did it. Don't scam yourself any further.
Yeah, don't scam yourself, I think, is the lesson here. And
I only, basically half my TikTok is Chess and then DJ Khaled saying stuff. And so one of them, he would say, don't scam yourself. Don't play yourself.
Yes, I think that's, and, you know, I mentioned that I did this in part because I could see the scope of the project based on its funding or lack thereof. But like you mentioned, this was always going to be a zine. This was always going to be a lower stakes project. And I never intended for it to be a soft cover book. I still went over my page count, but that's only because I did a more spacious layout. The writing,
the writing is
the same. So it's like, yeah, I just was more than ever honest with what the project was and to myself and to backers, and then made what I said I was going to make. And that's an achievement for me.
And then the very fucked up part is that, like, once you have done that and delivered it, you won. And now you can just sell it without having this freaky head trip about, like, what should this have been? What could it have been? I find that, like, over here, we price stuff at pretty much the top that you can price indie games at. And it means that, like, every time I sell something, I am satisfied. And not like, damn, I feel like I lost something in this equation. Like, it feels like it wasn't worth this. And then when you have, in the production and in the delivery, before you enter this long life of selling something, you can just be satisfied the day it comes out. And you're like, I did it. I said I was going to do it like this. It's great. People like it. And that's a huge game changer. We'll talk about this on another episode, but Discord Ghosts really felt like that to me, which was killer.
Yeah, that's sweet. Like, that's the goal. And I know we both have not done that plenty of times.
We fucked up. I fucked up so badly on this, which is why I can say this stuff.
And you know, Cyber Metal was this for me. It ended up being 140 pages or something when I intended to write 80, like double the length.
Yeah.
Is the game and the book better for it? For sure. Did I experience burnout multiple times and spend over a year on it? I did. And yeah. So,
like, are you describing Torque or Cyber Metal? I'm not sure which one you're talking
almost
about.
Almost everything we've worked on in the last 3 years.
Yeah.
Fucking.
And I. Yeah.
The Guide to Casting Phantoms.
Oh my god.
A game that we thought was going to be a zine, so we charged, what, $15, $20 for it? And we made a $16 cost boxed game with custom cards and shit. And, like, yes, the game is awesome, and it's a completely unique experience, but we absolutely fucked the scope on that.
Yeah.
And that's how this podcast started. Yeah. So we've been doing this from day one.
We're learning, we're growing, we're strong. What doesn't sink us gets us stronger. I think we are lucky that these games didn't sell a bazillion copies, because we would just be in a debtor's jail somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean because of that.
Yeah, on some level I'm acknowledging that we have to listen to our own bullshit here, and like,
yeah,
it's easy to give advice to somebody else and it's hard to take your own, but... Yeah, I think we are both moving in that direction of self-realization, and seeing any kind of progress and quantifiable success in that journey feels really good.
Exactly, and I can just sit here and be really proud of the work that you've done and the way that you've done the work, too, which is, you know... the opposite of dirty deeds done cheap. You have done pure deeds... done to cost and to scope accordingly.
Yeah.
I think on that note, this has been another episode of the Brain Trust Podcast. Adam, what you got coming out? What is going on? Where can people find you online?
You all should catch me on Patreon. World Champ Game Co. is the username. I think it's patreon.com.
My username is World Champ.
This is a dumb thing where it's like, I know on Itch my username comes before Itch, but on Patreon, I think it's a .com/ situation.
Yeah.
But so I'm not doing any games in March or April because of tour, but I'm going to just come back to that in May and be sharing stuff there. Currently working on a sword and sorcery game, the first Adam Vass true fantasy exploration, which is called Ooh. Flail. And I'm really excited for the future of that. The beta test Ashcan release is going to be coming through Patreon and through the Brain Trust Discord imminently. So check both of those out. And I'm on Twitter sometimes when the browser loads at WC Gameco. all my games are at worldchamp.io, including Sweet Revenge, which is available right now.
That Patreon is such a good deal. You're getting access to one of the most powerful backlogs in printed matter.
I also...
Just straight up.
Just as I just posted right before we started the call, but I only charge people when I publish something. It's not just a monthly subscription. So you never pay for nothing, even though I don't think there's anything wrong with that for people who do that model. Because I'm focused on print, and I use that money to make print runs. So March and April, I mentioned there's no releases, so people are not being charged for that. And I think that's fair and cool.
Nothing is nothing. yeah, go fucking go there. Put in the credit card. You know the deal. I've been Will Yobst. You can find me at will.com. You can find the games over at Good Luck Press and on Twitter. Additionally, Good Luck Press is on Tumblr, on Instagram. Go there. Go find us there. We have a super cool announcement this week, is that Seb Bynes is creating a interactive epistolary experience called Curios : Albrecht Manor, which is a super cool box of interactive letters and fiction that you will get in the mail. So this should be up for pre-order by the time this comes out, so go check it out at goodluckpress.co. All right, brain emoji, handshake emoji.